The Laps Factor Podcast.
What is up, College Lacrosse fans? You're watching episode number 280 of the Laps Factor Podcast. I am your host, Ted Hoost. It does sound crazy that we're up to episode 280 now. Today, I want to dive right into it, and I want to move on. No promo, no nothing. I want to get in, and I want to talk about North Carolina's game against High Point. The game of the day, by far, what we need to discuss here, because it's a serious problem, is Braden Maea is an absolute sicko for throwing that BTB pass down to Jack Sawyer, who's also a sicko, but less so of one, as it appeared that backhand that he stuck was kind of almost necessary in order, in terms of his best option to score that game-winning goal. But really, we need to talk about the huge brass balls that Braden Maea is walking around campus with. For him to feel that comfortable that he can toss that pass in that situation and then have the audacity to drop it in Sawyer's breadbasket so cleanly, his friends must intervene. The kid must be checked for toxoplasmosis. The dude has cat scratch fever because he doesn't give a fuck. He's out there driving fast, taking lots of chances. He's probably got three girlfriends here, all of them equally as serious a girlfriends. He doesn't mess around with a main girl and a side chick. He has three girls that all think they are the one. Braden Maea is disgusting. Now, I just showed that highlight, and I probably showed that highlight a couple times to get through my rant and everything like that. So this is where I must say, this video, all of the revenue for this video is now going to go to the copyright holder of that highlight. I will make no money off of this video. So if you have it in your heart to support this lowly podcaster and to make sure my children have food to eat, you could always go to laxfactor.com. You can get yourself a t-shirt, a hoodie, a mug, you know, whatever. We've got, you know, rando Club Lacrosse All-Star t-shirts, Garden Gnomes t-shirts, Lax Factor Podcast t-shirts, all sorts of crap. So you can support us that way. Now let me get back to this here. I had this game sitting on my side TV, and when it hit about 10-5, I switched it to a different game. I had no idea that High Point had gone on a 6-goal run when I switched it back from my other side game as I was prepping for the Cuse game and everything, pre-gaming. I switched it back right after High Point had tied things up at 11s, and then I almost shit my pants when I saw that game winner go in. So from a statistical standpoint, what did this fourth quarter look like for High Point? How did Carolina blow this lead? Over the fourth quarter, shots 12-5, HPU. Shots on cage, 8-0 in favor of High Point. Ground balls, 9-5, High Point. And faceoffs, High Point won 5 of 7 over the course of that fourth quarter. That explains the ground ball discrepancy. So simply put, High Point outplayed North Carolina. North Carolina apparently thought this game was won. Colin Krieg struggled over the course of that second half, as did the UNC defense. Sometimes a team that has enough talent to sting you like High Point, if you make them desperate, if you injure them, they will fight like a crazed junkyard dog, and that's what they did. UNC folded in all areas, offensively and defensively, but their defense's inability to get a stop down the stretch in this game, that was their real undoing. Now, what I love about this High Point team, post Asher Nolting, I wasn't sure what they were going to do. Asher Nolting is a generational talent. That is an absolute fact. That word's thrown around too much, but in this case, it is absolutely true. I didn't think that a guy like Braden Maea, who was primarily a goal scorer, and while playing with Nolting, it appeared much of his goal scoring was due to Nolting drawing slides, throwing dimes to him, and things of that sort. I was afraid his production might fall off a little bit. He was a known quantity. I figured it wasn't going to be hard for a team to stop a known quantity that's an off-ball guy. Look at Mac O'Keefe. You know, once Mac O'Keefe loses his line mate, he ends up having a much, much a muted goal-scoring output in that following season, his only season without what's-his-nuts running around on attack with him. So I was afraid that was going to happen to Maea. That did not happen to Maea. He goes for 62 points in 2023. That was a career high for him. And then averaging 5+ points a game so far this season, absolutely on point to put up 60+ points again for High Point. So that's huge. Enter guys like Jack Van Overbeek. He had a goal and 4 assists in this game here. 46 points so far this season, just 2 points behind Maea. He's been huge. It's a veteran High Point team, a bunch of seniors. So I'm just glad to see them get to taste a little bit of that magic, that upset magic that the teams from, 2019 to, 2021 or so. It's nice to see them be able to kind of get a little bit of taste of that magic. For High Point, their only path to the NCAA tournament, win their conference tournament. That's it. So we're not going to prognosticate on conferences that only put one team up where there's almost no chance of an at-large bid. But for Carolina, this is going to go down as a bad loss for them in terms of RPI. The Heels, they have a quality win over Penn, but that is it. Now, if you look at what they've got going on for the rest of the season, murderer's row right here. It's got to be the toughest schedule of any team over their final five games that anyone's going to see. They have Army up next. Then they have Virginia, Syracuse, Notre Dame, and Duke. Every single team has spent time in the top 10. I think almost all of these teams before the season's over will have spent time in the top five. So that is an absolute brutal stretch here. Now, I think if Carolina beats Army and then goes 0-4, they don't make the tournament here. I think if Carolina over this five-game stretch here, let's pretend we're not counting the ACC games any differently, being conference games or whatever. I think if they go 2-5 over this stretch, I think they're on the bubble, and depending on what other teams, they could potentially get in with that resume. They would have a quality win over Penn, the bad loss to High Point, but then they'd end up having good wins against any one of these teams. So 2-3 puts them on the bubble. They may be the last team out. Or the first team out. I think if they go 3-2 over this stretch and they can pick up three wins over this stretch, I think that probably gets Carolina in as one of the last teams in. And maybe it wouldn't even be that close at that point, because every one of these teams, as I said, probably finishes the season in the top 10. And every one of these teams has spent time in the top five at some point, or will spend, because Syracuse is about to be top five here this week, if not maybe even 2 or 3. And I bet you they'll get a couple of one place votes. First place votes. I made a joke that I would do that, but I won't. I'm not going to be that guy. Although the joke was pretty funny, I thought, let me just show you my joke that I made, just so you can all relish in my brilliance here. But my joke here was one thing. Probably people don't like guns, but yesterday at some point while I was watching lacrosse, I did have to clean a couple of handguns here. But where was my joke? Yeah, when Terrence Foy and Matt Kinnear see my media poll submission tomorrow night, has Cuse M. Lax sitting in each of the top five spots because Dylon was the five greatest rappers of all time. So if you don't get that joke, then you didn't watch the Chappelle Show, and you probably don't have a great sense of humor. But I thought that was some pretty witty shit, and credit goes completely to me for being funny. So anyway, that's it. I think they win three of their last five. I think they get in, you know, probably one of the first teams, one of the last teams in. If they go win four of their last five, giddy up, they're definitely in. But I feel like two of the last five probably gets them in, and we'll have to see. Now I'm just being annoying and rambling here. Maryland and Michigan, this game busted my so-called account-saving eight-game parlay, the only loss of that eight-game parlay I had on the slip. Maryland held an 11-10 lead late after Ryan Siracusa scored with 3:47 left in the contest on a dish from Danny Maltz. But just over a minute later, Justin Tiernan unleashed hell on the far side pipe, beating McNaney over his off-stick shoulder. That knotted things up at 11s with just 2:36 left in the game. The eventual game winner scored by Tiernan with 1:13 left on the clock. Just a situation of him being in the right place at the right time. Failed Maryland clear. Ball finds its way to Tiernan behind the defense. He darts in, gets under his defender, gets pushed into the goal mouth and scores. Now, what pissed me off about this call, it was a weak call. In terms of bang, bang, it did not look like a push to me. It looked like a player trying to force his way in front of another player whose goal was to get to the same point of the field. It looked like Tiernan fell into the goal mouth on his own with his own momentum. The Big Ten, being the morons they are, don't have replay. I do not think replay would have overturned the call. I think they had thrown the flag to cover their asses. It's a terrible rule, and every time a player now scores diving into the crease and into the goal mouth, or even just into the crease, the refs just throw a flag, so they can either call the goal mouth penalty on the player, or they can decide, was it a push, blah, blah, blah. I think it's a bullshit rule. It's stupid. They've got to fix it. Get rid of the goal mouth. If the player lands in the crease before the ball crosses the plane, count the goal, unless you have specific data you can show us that shows that it does put goalies at danger, and that there have been injuries in the last decade that are considerable enough for us to have to put up with this stupid shit. I actually said a word that was completely unacceptable in my first time through recording this thing, and I had to re-record the entire thing over again because I was like, well, there's no way I can let that work its way into my lingo as I'm saying this. So moral of the story, it's dumb. Fix the problem and I'll move on from that. Regardless, now I don't want to take away from Michigan because the rule's dumb. Sick goal by Tiernan. What a game by Tiernan overall. Michigan wins the game. He finishes the game with 5 goals off 9 shots, put 6 of them on Cage. Ryan Cohen, he adds 5 points to go with Tiernan's. He was 1-4 on the day. He shot poorly, but found some pals that were able to finish for him, so that works. At the faceoff dot, Justin Wheatfelt was big for Michigan. He wins 15 of 24 against Luke Wehrman. Maryland has lost in the only 2 games where Wehrman was below 50%, now Maryland has lost both of them. They did lose that other game to Virginia where Wehrman was better than 50%. But either way, 2 games, Wehrman's below 50%. Michigan or Maryland has lost them both. For Maryland, they've now lost 3 of their last 4. Losses to Notre Dame and Virginia by themselves, those don't look too bad overall. But throw in this loss to Michigan, not terrible, just not great. You also needed OT to beat Brown at home. So Maryland right now currently on notice. You know, they have Penn State, Ohio State, Rutgers, and Hopkins left. None of those games are gimmies. Now, if you're the sort of person that loves to prognosticate and make yourself sound stupid, which I do, you can see a path where Maryland could potentially finish the season by splitting those last 4 games that they have here. Let's take a look over here. So if Maryland splits these last 4 games, they're sitting at 7-5 going into the Big Ten tournament. What happens if they go 7-6 and they lose in that first round of the Big Ten tournament? Does Maryland get an at-large bid still with, you know, the quality wins that they have over, let's say, Syracuse and Princeton? Maybe if Richmond and Loyola just continue to win out and they punch their tickets to the tournament, then you can make the argument they might have as many as, you know, 3 or 4 quality wins if they weren't if they were to lose the wrong ones here. But I think that 2-2, you're probably in. 3-3, you know, you go 2-2, you're probably in. You go 3-1, you're almost for sure in, and then you still have the Big Ten tournament to play. The moral of the story is there is a world in which shit could just completely unravel for Maryland. They could lose 3 of these 4. They're not in the tournament unless they win the Big Ten tournament at that point. I do not think that's going to happen. To all the Terps fans, I believe in this Maryland team. I think this Maryland team just had a bad game against Michigan, a Michigan team that's good and played well on the day. I think that your chances of going 2-2 over the stretch are almost guaranteed. And I think there's a really good argument to make that they could probably go 3-1 over the stretch. But either way, they have the Big Ten tournament as a buffer. I think Maryland will probably, at the end of the day, be in the tournament. But this is definitely not what they're used to. They're not used to coming into their last 4 games saying, all right, hey, we got to win some shit to even get in, which is now the case because of these 3 losses here. And like I said, the Notre Dame loss and the Virginia loss doesn't really hurt them that bad, but you also have to stack quality wins, and that's what Maryland's going to be looking to do moving forward here. Yale and Cornell ended 18-15, kind of a battle between CJ Kirst and Matt Brandau as we get into here. Kirst gave Cornell a 3-2 lead early, scoring an unassisted goal with 5:59 left to play in the first quarter. Now, note on Kirst, he's been kind of quiet in terms of point production overall this season. So it was nice seeing the guys around him get better looks. No one's more dangerous than Kirst in 1v1 situations where he is the second Dodger in a sequence, especially if that first Dodger drew a slide. You get CJ Kirst on an island against his defender, things are typically going to go poorly, especially if he's not starting that dodge all the way up from a corner or the wing or something where he's getting a ball, you know, only 12 yards from Cage, where he's just got to take really 2 or 3 good steps to get past his guy and get a really good look off overall. But kind of we look at his point production, 4 points, 3 points, 5 points against Hobart, 8 against Ohio State. That was an incredible game, but then 3-2 again. So to come out and get 8 points against Yale, a quality opponent after the other 2 quality opponents they played recently have kind of shut him down. And he shot the ball terribly against Penn State, 22%, and then he was only 9% shooting against Princeton. So a great bounce-back game for Kirst. He's going to need to continue that. End of story right there. Kirst, he finished the game with, 4 goals, 4 assists. Even better, he forced 2 turnovers. Now we move over here to Matt Brandau. At one point, Brandau would tie things up at fours for Yale with 3:14 left in the first quarter. He's been playing at an extremely high level at this point, looking like the best attackman in the country as his line mates are out. His 42 points in 6 games, that's good for 7 points per game, leading the nation, and Yale has yet to play any chumps. Brandau finished this game with 5 goals and 2 helpers. And you look at what he's done against teams so far, 2-4 against Villanova. That's a good haul against a solid Villanova team. 6-7 against Colgate. They're not chumps. They've proven they can play ball this season. 1-2 against Penn State. Ho-hum. 2-3 against Denver. 8 assists against Harvard. And now 5-2 against Cornell. So, again, some pretty good competition. Brandao has been tearing things up. But even though the story of this game, every time Yale would tie things up again, it would end up being a guy like Kirst or somebody else that would come back, score a goal, give Yale back the lead, and that's all she wrote. And actually, that Brandao goal there, that gave Brandao tied it up at 4s, and then it was Hugh Kelleher feeding Kirst that caused Cornell to go back up 5-4, and it would just keep swinging like that. So, glaring issue for Yale in this one, after I just, butchered my freaking segment here on this game so far in terms of highlight flow and all that shit. Glaring issue for Yale in this game, though, they shot like shit. 48 shots, that was 9 better than what Cornell took all day, but only 28 of those 48 shots were on cage. Matthew Tully's 13 saves against 15 goals against, that's good enough to keep Cornell out on top as this game progressed. Yale did a good job keeping pace in this game by winning 21 of 35 faceoffs between Machado between Rodriguez and Ramsey. Machado, Rodriguez, and Nicholas Ramsey. They did a great job at the dot, but for Cornell, now we're going to move away from the game. Man, every once in a while, I butcher the flow of a thing to the point where I just want to hit stop, record, and move on. I'm not going to. We're going to muscle through this because I'm an animal. For Cornell now, we move into the prognostication aspect of this after I've already closed this out here. They've got quality. Let me just bring this up here. I don't want to lose the Cornell game or the Cornell and the Yale stuff. Okay. So Cornell, they now hold quality wins over Yale and Princeton, as we see here. They just beat Yale and Princeton back-to-back after that loss to Penn State. A loss to Penn State, a loss to Denver, not terrible for your prospects. So these are huge wins because you still got to stack wins. They've now got Penn up next, and then Syracuse, and then they get to play Brown, and then they play Notre Dame, Harvard, Dartmouth. So, I mean, they have chances here to pick up quality wins and get themselves into the NCAA tournament via an at-large, and they also have the Ivy League here as well. So, Cornell, lots of chances to improve and continue to build their resume. Now, Yale, oddly enough, it looks like they play more games than Cornell, but they don't. They're starting to get to the point now where they've played their quality opponents generally. They just lost here to Cornell. They did beat Harvard. They'd have that win over Denver. That looks great. And that loss to Penn State, not terrible. But moving forward in terms of resume building, Lemoyne and Brown next. Nothing. That's not going to help you. So long as you win those games, they're not really. Winning's going to improve your RPI a little bit. Losing them will be a killer. But then they got that win, a game against Penn, a game against Boston U. Those will both be quality wins if they can pick them up. But then you look, Dartmouth, Hofstra, Albany leading into Princeton. So Yale, they have work to do and they have lots of chances to pick up wins. But for them, they pretty much can't lose any of these games that aren't Penn or Boston U. They have to beat Brown. They have to beat Dartmouth, Hofstra, Albany. And then probably go 2-1 over the games between Penn, Boston U, and Princeton. And I think that probably puts them in a good place, and then they head into the Ivy League tournament. But that it's just not decided yet for either of these teams. Obviously, they have some more building of their resumes to do. We dig into the next game. I want to talk about Princeton and Harvard. Now, Princeton got this one by the end, 14-11 as I watched the game. I didn't feel it was as close as it was because despite tying the score up numerous times throughout, you had the feeling that even as Harvard was able to, even if they were able to bring it down to the wire, Princeton was always going to score the go-ahead goal. Probably Coulter Mackesy would have had something to do with it. Harvard had that had the game. Harvard was on top 3-1 early, but after Princeton rattled off a 3-goal run that was capped by Nate Kabiri, his second of the game, Harvard was never able to get over that hill again and regain control. Princeton always had the answer. Teddy Malone tied the game up at 4s for Harvard. Coulter Mackesy answered to give Princeton back the lead, 5-4. Miles Botkus got Harvard back to even at 9s. Then enter Sean Cameron, who scored on a dish from Mackesy. Princeton got control back and rolled from there. That just quick hit here. Mackesy feeds Cameron. Cameron's already loaded as he lets it rip from a very weak angle. And, just Princeton always had the answer. Now, I will say, credit Christian Bernard. Harvard's keeper with keeping his team in the game. He makes 20 saves on a day that saw Princeton getting just shots off at will. Princeton outshot Harvard 54-32 in terms of raw shots, and then 34-17 in terms of shots on cage. So without Bernard's effort, this game would have been over by halftime, as he had 12 stops over the course of the first half, six in each of the first two quarters. Harvard's man down unit, they stopped Princeton 4 of 5 times overall. Princeton was only 1 of 5 on the extra man looks. That also helped Harvard keep pace a little bit. The moral of my story here is I don't think this game was as close as it was. Harvard battled valiantly, but I think that there was a lot to be said about Bernard keeping his team in the game, and then Harvard just, you know, doing well in that extra man scenario, which also just kept a couple more goals of Princeton's off the scoreboard. But, you know, you figure Princeton even just hits their average in terms of extra man. Now it's a 15-11 score, maybe 15-10, something like that. For Princeton, their only signature win thus far is over North Carolina. They got that loss to Duke that does not look great because they got their dicks kicked in, but then Rutgers, they beat Rutgers, they lose to Cornell, they beat Harvard here. So their chances are running out. They've got Dartmouth, Lehigh, and Brown leading into Penn and Yale. So in terms of picking up quality wins, they have to win every single one of these games if they want any shot at an at-large. I think if Princeton were to lose any one of these games, that's going to shoot them in the foot for the at-large, because then they'd almost have to beat Penn and Yale, which is going to be a tall task coming in. Now, they're probably going to have the Ivy League tournament as play-ins as well, but Princeton needs to rattle off 3 straight wins now heading into that Penn and Yale, those Penn and Yale games to end their season, and I think they'll have to at least split those games to have a chance at an at-large. For Harvard, Harvard I don't think has a chance at an at-large. I shouldn't say it that way. Harvard has a chance at an at-large if they can go undefeated through the remainder of the season. I think Harvard gets an at-large no matter what. They'd beat if they can get a win over Virginia, Penn, and Cornell, that's probably a tournament-level resume, and they'd probably get in. They're not going to do that, though. Harvard has played a weak schedule thus far. They were able to get to 6-0 because of that weak schedule early in the season, and then they've lost to the first, you know, in that Michigan game, that's a decent win, especially now that Michigan just beat Maryland. So I'll take that back. They played a weak schedule up until their last 3 games, but they've only won 1 of those last 3. So they've got to do some damage here. A win over Virginia, it will look really good. I don't think that's going to happen, so it's going to come down to Ivy League play for them. Hobart and Syracuse. Now, Hobart did a great job defensively all game long, limiting Syracuse's offense and contesting the bulk of their shots. The outcome was about what I expected it to be. I probably figured maybe 15-7, 15-8, somewhere in there. But the weather obviously didn't help either team's output either. Credit Adam Shea, Mike Valent, who did a good job making sure Hobart didn't get wrecked at the faceoff dot. The way this score went, first half, Hobart won 8 of 13 draws, and that stat tracked with the 6-5 halftime score, 1 goal advantage to Syracuse at the half. Second half, Cone and Mullins, they go to work. They flip the battle at the dot in favor of the Orange. They win 8 of 11 over the course of the second half, and then that was all she wrote, is that possession advantage just bled into that 13-7 win for Syracuse. Now, for Syracuse, I've already seen the Joey Spallina Boo Birds running around getting all hype because Joey Spallina finished his game with no goals, 3 assists off 4 shots. They made the claim that it looked like he was uninterested and didn't care about being on the field. I disagree here. I think the reality is Spallina is doing what he needs to do to help his team stack victories, and I think he's not doing too much, and people want him to do too much. But when you do too much and you're getting every team's best defender and you're getting all of the attention, if you do too much, you're going to shoot yourself in the foot and it is going to hurt your team. And I think over this stretch, Spallina has done enough. I think he's played within himself. He's let the game come to him. It isn't like Syracuse doesn't have killers all over the field offensively. So I actually was pleased with him letting the game come to him on a day when other guys were able to put points up here. We see Moulet had 3 goals. Leo goes 1-2 on the day. English goes 2-1. I think also a factor in terms of the Syracuse offensive flow in this one, Owen Hiltz did not play, has a lower injury, probably like an ankle injury or something like that. He's apparently day-to-day. He apparently could have played in this game. They just chose to keep him out, get him ready for Notre Dame. I felt like you could tell the offense had a slightly harder time keeping their shit together here without Hiltz. The weather probably played into that, but if you watch these games, you will see often Hiltz managing the offense, Hiltz pointing around the field, Hiltz getting the ball after a clear, settling it down, making sure everyone's in their spot. He's also a better Dodger than Trey Deer is, at least at this point in Trey Deer's career. Deer looked like he was trying to not do too much as well, so that could change. If Deer got more time under his belt, he might, too, become more aggressive in terms of trying to score goals off that left wing. But I felt like not having Hiltz there hurt. It was great, though, seeing Deer come in. He shoots 2 for 4, has his first two goals of his career, so I thought that was awesome. Billy Dwan had 2 goals on the day. That was great to see, as he's both playing excellent defense and getting himself some points in transition. So now for Syracuse, if we're going to dig into their chances to make the NCAA tournament, and they have 4 games left here, I feel like they almost have a resume that gets them in. You've got the wins. Oh, you got the losses to Maryland and Army. Probably don't hurt you too bad. Those wins over Hopkins and Duke are huge. The win over Delaware is not terrible, depending on how Delaware finishes up. And then they still have 4 games left to pick up another quality win. I feel like if Syracuse goes 1-3 over their final 4 games, and they have the ACC tournament is back, it does not get them an automatic qualifier, but it does get them another chance at a quality win. I feel like if they go 1-3 over this final stretch here, they're probably the last team in at this point. If they go 2-2 over this stretch here, I feel like they're almost guaranteed a spot, depending on how it plays out here. I feel like if their only win over the stretch comes against Carolina, that's probably not going to be great for them. So if they go 1-3 over the stretch with a win over Carolina, they're on the bubble, I feel like, to a degree. And I think they probably get in. If they go 2-2 over the stretch, doesn't matter. I don't think how it splits up. I think they're good to go. Because if they beat Notre Dame and Virginia and then lose to Carolina and Cornell, not great losses in those two cases, but those wins would propel them in. If they beat Cornell and Carolina and lose to Notre Dame and Virginia, still two more quality wins to the total with decent losses, because no one's going to be mad at you for losing to those teams. So I think Cuse is pretty much in, so long as they don't go 0-4. If they go 0-4 over this final game stretch, now they're on the bubble. They're probably one of the first teams out, depending on how the ACC tournament would play out. So thank God they got the ACC tournament back, because it just gives them more chances to stack quality W's. Boston U Army. This game didn't surprise me. I couldn't bet on this game because Army is in New York, and I can't bet on any games that take place in New York. But if I would have picked Boston U to cover, which would have won me this bet. I did not expect Boston U to actually beat Army, but I felt like if there were games that you could say, hey, upset alert on the horizon here, this was one of the big games, because at 7-1, I just didn't have the feeling that Army really was the number one team in the country. I was one of the 3 media poll voters that gave the number one nod to Notre Dame, which even I didn't feel great about overall. Army's only signature win right now is against Syracuse. You know, you could call Rutgers a quality win. Boston U would have been probably a decent win, but that's it. Syracuse is their only good win, and now they've got that loss to Boston U. They didn't have a bad loss, and I don't think the loss to Boston U is going to count as a really bad loss, but they don't have a whole lot of chances from here to get quality wins. You're going to play Carolina. That beating Carolina would go a long ways in helping their resume. Losing to Carolina would be really bad. Then they got Colgate, Navy, Bucknell, Loyola. None of them ranked. None of them, you know, are a real threat. So could Army win out here? Yep. Army could win out and end up, what would that put them at? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That would put them at 12-1. That gets them into the NCAA tournament. They would be in regardless of what their conference tournament looked like. But you start dropping some of these conference games here, and now you're stacking bad losses. A loss to Navy, Bucknell, even Loyola would end up going down as bad losses. I'm not sure a loss to Carolina at this point wouldn't go down as a bad loss. So Army has work to do. If they can run the table, they're in. They also have the Patriot League tournament, but they have to be careful now. And I think they really, you know, to guarantee their chances of getting at least an at-large, I think they have to go 3-2 and pick up 3 wins against the best of these teams. I don't even know how it's going to break out, because actually, if you end up losing to the shitheads, you might not get in either. So Army has some work to do. I'm going to sit down here after I upload this episode and start trying to figure out up to before the games get played today, where am I at? And then I got to submit my poll tonight. So Army, I'm going to drop them quite a bit. I'll probably drop Army down as low as 5, maybe even 7, depending on what happens between Duke, Denver, and some of the other games that are being played today. So we'll see how that goes. Let's get out of here. Richmond, this game, I'm only talking about it because I had lost my 8-game parlay, which was supposed to be my DraftKings account savior. So this game, I put everything on the line that was the remainder of my balance in my DraftKings account, and Georgetown ended up winning me to keep me alive here so I can bet another day. So yeah, they end up beating Richmond. This one I thought was a weird, Richmond was favored in this one. I found that odd. So I took Georgetown both. I took a bet out on Georgetown on the money line and on Georgetown to cover in this one. So I just thought that was odd. And, you know, Alexander Vardaro, the Princeton transfer, he shows up, he goes for 5 goals. We run in here into the goalie battle. Anderson Moore has himself a game, 64% between the pipes for Georgetown. And then we dive into the faceoff battle. James Ball dominated him. So actually, considering all of those things, it's surprising the score is that close. But yeah, I figured Georgetown would win that game. I took them every way I could in terms of betting situation, and it kept my DraftKings account alive. My balance is not zero. I stink. This game was originally the game I was sweating here, St. Joe's and Providence, because my parlay, my 8-game parlay included St. Joe's on here, and St. Joe's goes down late. They have to tie it up late on a crazy goal with like 3 seconds left. They get a look in overtime, don't get a good shot off. Now Providence has the ball. They get a stop, come back down, score the game winner here. That was awesome. I will say, Torrin Eccleston, I believe he's a midfielder. Is he a midfielder or an attackman? Either way, he dodged a lot from out top. 4 goals. That dude's, he looks dirty. We know Carter Page is dirty. We know Levi Anderson's slow, big, and lumbering, but he can put up points. But I'm a big fan of this Torrin Eccleston after watching this game here. And St. Joe's, in terms of goalies, holy shit, Tommy Gross had a gross day. 2 saves against 11 goals against. That's absolutely atrocious. And faceoff dot, Gavin Tai, Virginia transfer. Actually, I think he played at Virginia, then he might have, or maybe he played at Maryland, transferred to Virginia. Maybe it was Virginia, then Maryland. So the dude's a journeyman, but he's had success this year here at the faceoff dot for St. Joe's, winning 48%. But he's played against some really good competition. So 76% here, and then 57% against Penn. That's not terrible, but either way, that game kept my parlay alive. It didn't matter because Maryland lost and screwed me over terribly. Virginia beat the ever-living shit out of Drexel. Peyton Cormier goes for 6 goals on the day. Schellenberger, 1-2. And you see this a lot now. Guys like Schellenberger, guys like O'Neill, they're going to be prone to having down games. You hear a lot, you see a lot more than you did in the old days of really good players, sometimes the top 5 guys in the country, going out in a game like O'Neill did against Syracuse and just having a down game. The way that defense is played today is different than the way that defense was played 15, well, more than that, like 20 years ago. So I heard mentioned like the Powell brothers never got shut down. And it's like, well, that's not true. Mike Powell, by the time he was doing battle with the Princeton teams that changed how defense is played because of Bill Tierney, he did have some more down games against teams like that, because it went from being, hey, you got 1 or 2 slides back in the 80s and the early 90s to, by the end of the 90s, you were getting 3 and 4 slides deep. And that was because Princeton figured out how to slow the pace of play through crazy defensive schemes that involved all 6 guys being involved in the rotations and the help defense. And that change in how help defense was played lowered the scores of games to the point that we had the shot clock. So the fact we even needed a shot clock in the sport of lacrosse tells you that the way defense is being played changed. And part of that is it does put you in a position where some of these just sickos like Schellenberger, O'Neill, you name them, that they can be stopped and bottled up a little bit more. And especially throw in the fact that these players also have dudes around them that are all killers. At times they're going to be willing to play second fiddle when you know you've got a killer that can pick up the slack for you on a day that you're not having a great day, or on a day that you have a defender that's just an absolute monster beating you up. And in this case, it was just, he didn't need to put up a bunch of points. He didn't. Peyton Cormier did. Griffin Schutz put up a bunch of points. That's going to be dangerous for teams moving forward in terms of Virginia, is when Griffin Schutz starts playing like this. You know, 1 goal against Michigan. Or no. 2 points against Michigan. You know, quiet here. Big game against Hopkins. Quiet again, Robert Morris and Towson. 4-2 against Maryland, an absolute monster of an outing, and now 3 goals against Drexel here. If he can find his place on the field, because he's kind of one of the guys that you would have thought maybe by now would have been one of the starting attackmen, it doesn't pan out because they just keep bringing just filthy dudes in. So now he's playing midfield trying to find his role. I mean, if he can start playing well and start finding the back of the net for this Virginia team, it's going to be trouble across the board here. Albany They beat Vermont. I watched just a little bit. I like Silas Richmond. I just want to say that. I am a big Silas Richmond fan. The dude scores goals. The dude scores highlight reel goals. The guy's been getting it done here lately. What did he have here? 7 goals against Virginia. Monster day. That kind of put me like, oh, shit, man. Silas Richmond's tearing it up. And now 4-1 against Vermont in a win. So credit to that kid. He's literally the only reason I wanted to talk about that game. But that is a – oh, wait. No. Hold on. We got to talk about Pisano, too. Where'd it go? Did I lose it? Oh, I'm just reloading the same page here. Let's move away, and let's go down. Pisano. Okay, he only had an assist here. So his outing today was a little bit pedestrian, but against Virginia, the long pole midfielder, 2 goals against Virginia, ended up guarding Schellenberger. Like, the dude, he's just a filthy future pro. I know guys are blowing him up, but that name, you are going to hear his name being called over and over again at the pro ranks. The dude is an absolute killer, and he's proven that. All right, moving on here. Loyola Lafayette, ho-hum. 18-10, Loyola beats Lafayette. I only talk about it once again because it was one of the games that was in my parlay. And Minikis 4-5 on the day. Evan James 3-3. That attack for Loyola, you know, depending on the competition, they tear it up. If they could play consistent lacrosse, Loyola down the stretch will have, you know, they could be a scary team. And that's kind of how Loyola's been. Loyola hasn't had the best regular seasons since the Pat Spencer days, but it hasn't stopped them from making the tournament here and there and being a danger. So their attack just needs to be more consistent, and that kind of shit will continue. They've got Lehigh, Bucknell, Holy Cross, Navy, and Army up. So 3 very winnable games leading into their season-ending games against Navy and Army. Delaware beat Hofstra. This game was in question for quite a while. Mike Robinson was the one who kind of kept Delaware in it early. Looks like J.P. Ward got his shit together at some point, and they roll. Hofstra, I always just like to check in on these guys here. Achione, I think is how you pronounce that. 3 goals. I'm a big fan of him. Just watching some of these games here now that I've been forced to buy Flo, I'll catch up and watch a little bit more Delaware, but I like this kid, number 45 for Delaware. He had 3 goals on the day. Dartmouth and Penn, once again, part of my parlay. I mention it for that reason here, but because we're kind of getting into Ivy League play, and Penn and what they do is going to play into the RPI for a lot of other teams, even outside of that conference here, I just wanted to touch on it and the fact that Penn did end up winning this game, but Dartmouth kept it interesting for much longer than anyone did, and it's Tynan Walsh for Penn, who goes 4-1. And they win this game. Did Carroll struggle? Emmett Carroll didn't struggle. I was just trying to figure out and see if there was anything statistically that stuck out that made this look rough. I think the weather, that's obviously a huge factor in this one. The weather was absolutely fucking atrocious in this game, so I'm sure that played. But hey, Penn guts out a win in terrible weather. The games that are on the slate here today, Duke and Denver, Ohio, and it's Denver at Duke, Penn State at Ohio State, and Johns Hopkins at Rutgers. So in this one, I did take a 3-game parlay to once again try to keep my DraftKings account alive. I've got Duke, Penn State, and Hopkins money line in my 3-game parlay to keep my account going. If I lose that bet, I am done, and I've just burned my DraftKings account down to 0 because I'm the absolute worst lacrosse better that's ever existed, you know, that's ever lived. And then as we come into the calendar here and we see what's up for Monday, we got Brown and Villanova, nothing really big there. Yale Lemoyne, who cares? So Wednesday slate of games, a little bit interesting. We got Duke hosting Boston U. That should be a big one, a chance for Boston U to kill one of the juggernauts and pick up a huge quality win, a chance for Duke to actually pick up a win against a good opponent that would look good for their RPI. And that's it really for midweek games there. And then in terms of the rankings, like I said here, Army, I am definitely going to drop them. Now, these guys play today. Duke and Penn State play today, so I don't know what I'm going to do with them. Notre Dame doesn't play this week, and I think Notre Dame may, because they haven't played enough games yet, they may fall victim to not losing but not getting my number one nod this week. So we'll see how that goes when I sit down to do it. But Syracuse, they're definitely going to be on the rise. Duke, maybe if they beat Denver, maybe I only drop Duke down to here and bump Syracuse up. Maryland's going to drop. Yale loses, they're going to drop. What's Denver going to do today against Duke? That's going to, you know, decide, or do they get to stay in the top 10 or not? Georgetown's win over Richmond, I'm probably going to bump them a spot or two. So, you know, these are all the things. Hopkins, once again, they have, what they do today will determine how I sort this out. So I have a lot of work to do here after I set this up, trying to figure out my poll vote. And that's it. As always, be sure to like, subscribe, hit the notification bell if you're watching on YouTube. You can go to laxfactor.com. You can get t-shirts, hoodies, hats, shorts, beer glasses, coffee mugs, you name it. The t-shirts tend to be the best sellers, so get yourself a t-shirt if you want to support the channel, especially when I get forced to put BTB assists, you know, highlights in a BTB assist that end up, you know, resulting in upset wins and shit like that. So you can go to laxfactor.com, support us that way. And that's it. I will do one video during the week. I don't know what it's going to be. The preview show is just really hard for me to get to come Thursdays. So probably what I'll do is maybe put out a show Thursday talking about, like, picking a game and just covering that game in depth. That'll be easier for me to do. But I'm just going to try to stick with Sunday show as we're doing it. And then during the week, I'm going to try to get any level of show out to talk about things. It'll just vary in terms of what day I end up getting them out. Work has been absolutely brutal. So whenever I've disappeared and you've expected a show and you didn't get it, I apologize. But like I said, the podcast doesn't pay me all that much money. The work that I do in full as my, for my full-time job pays me a lot of money, and I have to honor that. And there's just days when I just cannot get away long enough to put out a quality show. And I've just been erring on the side of not putting anything out if it's going to be a piece of shit. So that's it. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Be sure to come back next Sunday for another show, and then watch during the week to see what I drop. That's it. Hoost is out.
The Lax Factor Podcast.